Okay, welcome back to another episode of I'm a Software Engineer, What Next? Good to be back, Matt.
Hey, James, good to see you again.
You too. Have you got a new t-shirt on there? I can't see any text, so I don't know.
I do. So if you're Australian, you know the phrase, yeah, nah, which is a very Australian way of saying, I sort of hear you, but I don't necessarily agree or disagree. Right. It's a bit like hi in Japanese or acknowledge. Right. But it's also a bit of a brand of a YouTuber called Aussie Man Reviews. Check his website out. He's a pretty funny guy.
That is Aussie Man Reviews. Yeah.
Yeah. This is the second Christmas present. The last T-shirt was from one child, and this T-shirt was from the other child.
Well, Christmas. They know what to get you. I feel like yeah, nah is no, and nah, yeah is yes. Is that right? I think that's
no.
The science.
Nah, yeah, nah. Nah, yeah, nah.
Anyway, moving on. This week we've got a new guest joining us with a lot of experience. I'm going to do my best to introduce Dan, our guest, and then he can tell me how accurate I am with this description. Today we're talking to Dan Moore, a developer who's worn almost every hat in tech. He's been a back-end engineer, a leader managing teams, a consultant, a startup founder. He's built a developer relations function from the ground up, now sits on an exec team at FusionAuth in the US. Along the way, he's written a book for new developers, crashed a national TV website, learned hard lessons from layoffs and failed projects, and found ways to keep growing without always climbing the ladder. Dan's career is all about navigating change, building influence, and learning from the messy parts of tech life. Welcome, Dan.
Glad to have you here, Dan.
Thanks for inviting me on, and I wish that we hadn't led with a national TV website crash, but...
You have to start there. You cannot do anything other than start there now.
Yeah, you want me to talk about it a little bit?
Yeah.
The one bit of flavor I'd add is that most of my career has been at small companies. I've contracted at like a company like Oracle, which is obviously a huge company, but as far as an employee, I've been mostly companies under a couple hundred people. So, okay. And that's actually one thing I wanted to kind of lay out here for your listeners is all advice is contextual. And so if you're trying to get a FANG job right now, I would fast forward past this, right? Or maybe like listen to it all with a grain of salt, because there's still some useful tidbits in here that we're going to talk about. But like, I've never applied to Google or Facebook or Meta, whatever it's called, or those kind of companies. So
that's good to know. One thing I was going to add is that of all the guests that we've had on, I don't think we've had someone who's probably put as much thought into giving advice to engineers as you. So for that reason alone, I'm really excited. And I think no matter where you're applying, people will learn something from your experience.
And so let's start right there before you tell us the story about the crashing TV station. One of the things that really stood out to me when you reached out was this this to a new developer, right? And one of my favorite questions, interview questions, which we've now turned into the opening question on the podcast, is imagine you've got a magic phone and you can call yourself 20 years ago. What's the advice that you would give to yourself back then that you know now that would help you, you think may help you, get through the next 20 years?
I think that the piece of advice that I would give to myself 20 years ago, frankly, basically I would tell myself to write a book sooner.
Interesting.
Because I think that I had a lot more free time in my 20s than I do now. And if I had I did some writing. I haven't blogged since 2003. But if I had been a little more focused, I think I could have set myself up a little bit better for now. That's one thing that I think that I didn't realize when I was younger as a dev is that you have a lot of obviously, it depends on your family situation and your finances and things like that. But a lot of people have more free time earlier in their career than they do later. So taking some of that free time and turning it into a durable asset, I think would be my one piece of advice.
Your advice to do that sooner, is that because of what you learned along the way for yourself as writing a book, or because writing a book has given you better exposure as an engineer?
I'm not sure.
Opened up doors, or I think of if I went and wrote a book on recruitment, I would probably have to think about things differently than just performing the role.
Yeah. I think that's probably a good way to put it. Like, I don't think you should ever write a book for the money. I can tell you roughly how much money I made from the book that I wrote and other books that I've written. But I think it does give you a piece of credibility. It gives you a great way to introduce yourself around to other folks. But The bigger win, I think, is the forced introspection around something. And mm-hmm. I'll tell you, I've written books where I spent 2 hours on a single sentence or two sentences. And that's more from the technical perspective, right? Letters to New Developer is really a book about opinions. And so that's more a coalescing of experience. But I've also written technical books where you're like, how does that work? And then you need to find that out. And so you will dig deep about whatever topic you write about mm-hmm. whenever you're writing a book. If you want to write a quality book, I guess I can set aside people who... Actually, I tried to do this. It's been only a couple minutes. Let's bring AI in. I tried to write a book about...
Ding!
Customer identity access management. I was like, I'll use Claude to write most of it. And I wrote, had it write an outline, had it write a couple of chapters, but with me prompting, and I stopped. I was like, this feels empty. This feels yeah. vacuous. This feels like average, right? Which is what yep. you expect if you ask AI to write it. And I just stopped. So if you write yourself, you're not gonna have, it may be horrible or it may be great, but it won't be vacuous and middle of the road. And it will force you to introspect deeply about things.
Okay.
Right. Super interesting. So I want to put a footnote on that because I've got some strong opinions on this stuff. I have been spending an awful lot of time with Claude recently writing code and writing like other content. And what I agree with you, like really, really deeply agree with one bit of what you said, which is if you just let it go and let it do the de novo creative content, it's absolute crap, right? It really is, comes out absolutely hollow. It's a really good, and also the joy of writing, to the extent that writing is a joy, and it's a bit like a really heavy, you know, like a really heavy massage. People really enjoy these really heavy massages, and I hate it. I think they're terrible. But I think what people enjoy about a really heavy massage is it's stopping, right? The bit when it stops, you go, oh, it's finished, right? And I think writing a book is a bit like that, you know, like the joy of it comes from having completed it, not necessarily in doing it. But anyway, having said that, but what Claude is fantastic at, and this is true for code as well as writing, is help me structure this or give me some bullet points that I can then embellish or hang on. What have I done that's inconsistent here? These kinds of things, like the kind of mechanical, crafty type things, as opposed to the art type things, I've found Claude to be extraordinarily powerful.
Yep.
So yeah, it's an interesting one. What books have you written? You say books. It sounds like you didn't.
So most of the other ones were self-published. Just okay. To be totally blunt, there's a great site out there called LeanPub that I recommend anybody who's thinking about writing a book do. I have one about Cordova CLI, which is like this tech thing that I wrote in 2012 or 2011. And then I've written a number of either written or collated or edited or contributed to a number of other books. I guess the other one that was published in, I contributed to 97 Things Every Cloud Engineer Should Know, which is Noah Riley's book.
97.
And had a lot of fun writing that. That was more focused on cloud computing.
And I think I know the answer to this, but I'm curious to know that, like, what is it that motivates you when you change or when you have stepped perhaps back into an IC role? What's behind those decisions? How have you come to those decisions?
When I moved to being an individual contributor, like I wanted a job, right? This was in the late 90s. And one of the motivations I chose software at all was because I had done this project for my parents at a small insurance company, and they had a mail merge problem, and they were manually like mailing, people used to do this, manually mailing letters out. And I was able to do mail merge, which solved this problem. And I saw how amazing software could be at relieving human toil. And so that made me want to step into software as a profession. When I moved into leadership, to be honest with you, I think this happens more often than we think. I fell into it. A CTO, it was a small team, and the co-founder/CTO left. And so they needed someone to run the engineering team at this real software forward real estate brokerage. And I also was interested in more impact and more money and learning new skills. And I always say that being a manager, an engineering manager, is a little bit like, is as close to being an engineer as being an American footballer is to being a European or I guess world footballer, right? There, the games are similar, right? There's, you score points, you have a goal, there's a, you know, finite amount of time, but like the mechanics are totally different and the skills are totally different. So it's a whole new skill set. So I was interested to try to learn that and I tried that a couple of times. And actually that was one of the reasons I moved into DevRel, is because I had tried engineering management a couple of times. I liked the money. I liked the impact. I did not like managing people, and I did not want to put in the time to be better at that, right? I have colleagues and friends, and I'm sure your listeners know these folks who love managing people. They love finding what makes people tick and helping them grow, and they may not love the harder parts of the job, but they accept them as part of the parcel. And I did not want to do that for the rest of my career. So I pivoted to DevRel because I had this background in writing, this background in community, and it was interesting to me to try. And I was kind of, frankly, sick of design patterns, or that's a shorthand for saying, like, and I've seen this in other engineering groups, even today at Fusionauth, like the level of, I don't want to say tedium, tedium's the wrong word, but like the level of focus and like the level of arguing over some things that are not, in my opinion, like going to drive the business is something that I think is part of the engineering mindset. And I had kind of grown tired of that or wanted to explore different pieces of that. And then as far as kind of strategy, I was very clear at my current company that when it came time to grow the DevRel team, I did not want to be the person to do that. I was happy to kind of do initial hiring, but I am not a team runner, and that's something I've learned about myself. But I was looking to lever up still because, and we can talk more about this, but I think that if you want to make more money and you want to have more impact, then you have to find leverage. And there's a couple of different ways to do that. The ways I can think of are, you can scale up your knowledge, you can scale up your effort, or you can scale up your visibility. So okay, what do I mean by knowledge? That means like diving deep and being like a world expert in, maybe world is grandiose, sorry, an expert of some kind in some technology, right? Like there is a guy, Nate Berkopek, who is the Rails performance guy. He's written books about it. He's the guy that you know. He does workshops, blah, blah, blah. He's really focused on a specific problem that is a pain point for companies, right? So that's scaling knowledge. Scaling effort, I think, is more of the engineering manager, right? Where you start to learn how to manage a team or a team of teams and point everybody in the same direction and get larger effort things done. And then the scaling visibility, which we talked a little bit about, which is where you write, you speak, you are part of a community, and that means that your actions have more impact than they would if you were somebody that nobody knew. So those are kind of three ways I think of for technologists to scale and therefore kind of get that impact, get that money.
You said something that I've said a few times and I really like. It's this idea that being promoted to management is not a promotion to management is not a promotion. It's a career change, not a promotion. And the thing that they don't tell you, and it's not on the back of the cereal box, is that going to leadership from management, which are two different things, is another career change, because the skills are, as you said, you know, they're as different as American football to soccer. So that's interesting. One of the things that James and I have spoken about before is this idea of the kind of ceiling, the IC ceiling that you tend to hit, and it's really bad in Australia. There just isn't a way to get beyond a certain point as an IC or continue to get more money, prestige, whatever it might be, unless you go into management. And it's just locked off, okay? Over here in the UK, in London, in my experience, and I get James's experience in Europe, but in London, in UK, London, it's not quite as bad. There are opportunities for you to grow as an IC, but there is still a bit of a ceiling. But one thing that I've seen in the US is that the ICs go all the way to the top. Right, you know, in particularly in the FANGs, you can be like a distinguished engineer or a fellow, okay, and you don't have any management responsibility at all. But you are, you know, globally recognized in a topic area or whatever. I wonder, have you worked in Europe? Have you seen this? Like, do you have any advice to people trying to navigate past that boundary condition there, which is, hang on, you've hit the IC ceiling. How do I keep going and still grow?
Yeah, I mean, this is something that actually was discussed at my first job. They were talking about having a parallel track. And so I can't really speak to like how to implement this in your company if your company doesn't support it. But I think that, you know, first of all, well, are you asking like how people in Australia or Europe could like help solve this problem? Is that what you're asking? Or?
Well, no, I guess what I'm interested in is, what have you seen when people have cracked that sort of tech lead role and then they've gone on to be like a super IC? What is it that they've done that's allowed them to make that leap?
Yeah, I mean, well, I do want to point out there's a third or a fourth path here, which is actually just being a contractor.
Yeah.
Because right? Contractors are super ICs in my mind. And I definitely have dealt with contractors that were paid plenty of money, right? And that's a different trade-off. right? Because you don't have security and you don't have like company behind you, but you do get some of that. So I guess I would say that you kind of said that you these super ICs don't have managerial responsibilities. And I would say they don't have direct managerial responsibilities, but they do take ownership of large chunks of things. Mm-hmm. And the same way that a VP, I mean, you kind of talked earlier about like the move from management to leadership is different. And I think one of those aspects is the ownership aspect. And I think that if you are going to be a super IC, principal engineer, et cetera, you are going to need to take ownership of things, which unfortunately means that you might be wrong sometimes and that might cost you. But if you only take direction, then you can't make the leap is what I would say. So does that make sense?
Yeah, yeah, it does indeed. That's a great segue into failure. So I'm a huge fan. This is going to sound insane, but I'm a huge fan of failure in the sense that failure is a much better teacher than success. Success hides a lot of problems and people are successfully one dimension. And they, I said to someone the other day, actually, that I was talking about a change that I'm trying to implement in a company I'm working with. And it's like the seeds of our failure, future failure, are sown in the soil of our past success. Right. And so it's a kind of poetic way to think about it, but it's really true. And so I always find it interesting when to talk to people. It's like, okay, what's your biggest failure? What did you get wrong? And importantly, what did you learn from it?
Yeah. So, I mean, one of them that jumps right to mind is going back to that, my career path where I was decided I didn't want to be an engineering manager. And one of those was because I had a direct report who A, managed the way that I would want to be managed. I pushed her. I encouraged her to take classes. I did other things that in retrospect I was not listening to her. And so she ended up requesting to move to a different manager. And that really gutted me. Mm-hmm. And what I learned was two things. One is you need to manage people the way they want to be managed, not the way you want to be managed. And the second was that I didn't want to put in the effort to kind of make that leap and really mm-hmm. understand that. So in some sense, that failure determined my career direction and led me into developer relations. And so I'm thankful for that. It was super unpleasant when it happened, as failure often is, but that was an example. And I have other examples that are more around like projects that have gone awry, but that was definitely, if I had to pick something that was one of the biggest impacts on my career, that would be it.
So you said something that's really interesting as well. So you said you've had a few different cases. Like what are the common patterns? What are the signals that pop out in those failure scenarios? Have you seen any pattern? Have you got any built up any pattern recognition to look out for?
I mean, I think that some of it is, there's this tension in technology between moving fast and like getting stuff done and stopping and listening. And I've always been a question asker, but I think that sometimes I do the first level of question. I don't do the second, third, fourth level of questioning that I think you really need to understand something. And I think there's and this is definitely not something I'm an expert in, but I think that there's almost an intuitive sense you need to have of what category of problem is this? Is this something that I need to dig in way more and understand? Or is this something that I can kind of figure out and take steps to understand, do actions to increase my understanding, right? Even those actions might be harmful or counterproductive. Sorry. In some cases, taking action will be harmful or counterproductive. In other cases, it helps educate you. And so you need to kind of decide when you're confronted with an issue, whether it's the first category of problems or the second category of problems.
Dan, it sounds like the saying that we say failure is a better teacher than success. So some of these failures, let's say call it a failure, where your reportee decided to move teams, have had the biggest impact on your career in terms of what you wanted to do next. So whilst it's obviously tough at the time, it's probably shaped your career more than anything else.
100% agree. And I think that as I get further along in my career and I have more failures to look back on, like that actually gives me, in some ways it's freeing to free me up to fail more now, right? Because I can look back and say, hey, the world didn't collapse. Unless you were a banker in 2008, right? In which case, maybe things are a little bit different. But like, no, the world's not going to collapse. I'm going to learn something from this, and it's going to improve me. Means that perhaps you can take bigger risks, right? Like, if you have that opportunity to go be an engineering manager, go try it, because you will fail in some ways and succeed in others, and you'll learn something from those failures. Failure is so hard in the moment. I think everybody who cares about their job and cares about the people they work with doesn't want to fail. But if you look back over it, it's where it helps you determine where to turn in a way that success, I mean, I guess success does too, right? If you're successful at X, what's that quote? Jason Langsdorf, who's a web dev influencer, says like, in most companies, the success you get for eating pie, the reward for eating pie is more pie. So more success means that you're going to like be given more of that kind of work. And so that's a lesson in and of itself too.
Yeah, be selective about what you're being successful in. Otherwise, you're just going to get a lot of pie.
There's that old quote about like, don't put technologies you don't want to work with on your resume, because if you do, then you will probably work with those technologies.
Is there an approach you have to making it safe to fail? Like, particularly in teams where you've got public facing products, for instance, like how do you know when it's a good time to take a risk and when you...
Sure. So I think the first thing here, and this gets to the socio-technical aspect of software development, is that you need to understand what your boss's priorities are as best as you can, because at the end of the day, that's the person who will be fighting for you. And so if you fail and you do it in a way that causes them to look really bad or causes a project that was really important to them to get sidelined, that's going to be a bigger issue than if you fail in a way that moved their project forward or that was a smaller thing. So I think understanding the priorities of your boss and to some extent of larger business, that's a really good thing for you to understand. I also think that it's important as a leader to share your failures. So that I'm a huge fan of like public Slack channels, because that's a little like every time that I get corrected in a public Slack channel or I say I didn't know that, that's a little failure. That's showing other people that it's okay to do that kind of thing. And again, that's a very small scope, but like you build that culture of, oh wow, Dan just said thank you. You educated me on this thing that I would have thought Dan knew, is something that you can stand up in front of people with a PowerPoint deck and say, hey, share your failures all day long, but like it's way more powerful for you to share them in a way that's like not grandiose and is just kind of in the normal course of everyday interactions.
Yeah. So you said about asking questions, vulnerability, right? The way to build trust with people is through some genuine, authentic vulnerability, not oversharing and, you know, sharing for the sake of it, but just a genuine vulnerability. And one of the most vulnerable things you can say is, I don't understand, right? Particularly as a leader, you know, and you said in your notes, you're like, I don't understand. And it's like, okay, teach me the thing that I don't understand. It reminds me of that I think a physicist said this about the two most powerful words in science or in physics are, that's interesting, right?
Totally.
Because like hang on, here's something like, this didn't go how I expected it. What's going on, right? And I think that's it's the essence of curiosity. Okay, you've said something here, and I've got it highlighted, and I really like this, and I'm hoping you can talk to this, because I think this could be a whole podcast. I'm just looking at FusionAuth and your work there, and you made this comment: solving an undifferentiated problem that is scary in a unique way can lead to success. So, in contrast to the failure conversation, talk to me about what that means.
Well, this is really in the context of FusionAuth, which, if your listeners don't know, is an authentication provider, right? So, authentication is important for every application. If you'd asked me about authentication 10 years ago, I would have said it's boring and it's a little bit scary because it involves security of your users. And at the same time, it's across every application, which is why, frankly, it's a good thing to be outsourced, whether you outsource it to a product like FusionAuth or an open source library or something like that, right? Like the days of writing your own authentication are gone, should be gone, but unfortunately not. But I think that the value that, to kind of zoom out a little bit to think about careers, authentication is not the only scary problem out there. Performance is another one that we talked about earlier. Knowing the intricacies of who scale something, security in general, knowing from an engineering manager perspective, knowing how to commit to an estimate and be able to deliver on that. Those are all scary things because they're high risk. And so if you can figure out a way to solve a problem that's scary, and then, well, here's an interesting idea. Like you could have a problem that's scary that is like totally related to like a piece of code in your company's infrastructure that no one wants to touch, right? That is scary, so it's somewhat valuable to the company that you own this piece of functionality and you can make changes to it or you can like keep it running, but it's not undifferentiated, right? It's super differentiated because it's super tied to that company's application.
Yep. Yep.
So that's going to limit your career prospects because you can't take that. You might be able to take 50% of it, right? Like it depends on what it is, but like you may take some portion of that knowledge and move it to something else. But if you are really good at JVM tuning, then guess what? There's a roughly speaking a bajillion companies out there that want to hire you, yeah. you know, to tune their JVM. So that's scary still because it's performant, it's high risk, but it is undifferentiated. I think, and again, I don't know where your listeners are in their career. Certainly I wouldn't recommend that someone like super specialize a year out of school because there's an explore versus exploit continuum that you want to like look at. But like at some point, like picking something that's undifferentiated and scary and solving it in a way that is relatively unique, right? There's nothing new under the sun, so it can't be 100% unique, but is relatively unique will give you a leg up. And that's actually one point I'd make is that every employer wants employees to be fungible. And every employee does not want to be fungible. Don't be fungible. Don't be someone that you can slot in. Don't be a Java engineer too, or a you know, React developer, you know, with 3 years of experience. Like, be differentiated because you want people to say, "Hey, I want to work with Dan, not I want to work with React dev, you know, with 3 years of experience."
That's a really good point. I think that leads on well to another question I wanted to ask. Basically, the future of a software engineer, and that is a lot of what we talk about. Like, what skills matter more or less for engineers now? Like, looking forward to, say, the next 5 years, what do you think if you were a software engineer, maybe come out of university, or you've had a couple of years as an IC, what do you think is most important for them to consider?
And that's actually the reason I wrote the book and wrote the blog post, is because I'd written a technical book. We talked about the Cordova book. And I said, what can I write that will be useful in the future? And because the Cordova book I wrote, and then like about 3 months later, it was out of date and I wasn't going to update it. And so it was basically kind of a sunk cost. I think Letters to a Developer will be useful in 10 years. And there's no mention of generative AI in there at all.
Yeah.
And the truth is that people don't hire developers to write code. They hire developers to solve problems. And generative AI, in my mind and in my experience, which I will grant, you know, is limited. I'm not on the frontier of the AI revolution by any means, but I definitely have talked to people who are. It is just like memory managed languages, just like IntelliSense, just like compilers. It is another tool to solve problems that lets you lever up to a higher level of basically abstraction. So what does that mean? Well, that means you need to be good about like the other things, right? When something becomes easier, when software becomes easier to write, well, what are the things that become relatively harder? Well, distribution becomes harder. So knowing how to like talk to people about your software, sales and marketing become harder, even building the right thing, right? AI makes it so easy to build things. Well, I've heard this, you know, people talk about taste being an important thing. I think taste is important. But you could back out taste and say it's actually just knowing what's the right thing to build, which means talking to people, looking at like what people want, being an ICP, an ideal customer profile yourself, working with people that have different skills. One of the things, I did a startup and it was an amazing pairing because I had an interest in local food systems, and I found an expert in local food systems who was CEO who, her limit of her technical skills was like, you know, setting up Google Forms, but she was a really good product person and I was a really good technical person, and I was able to learn from her and she was able to learn from me, and it was a great pairing. I think with AI in the future, all those skills that aren't coding are going to become even more important, even for someone who knows how to code.
Yeah, this is a great point, right? I'm sure you've heard the phrase that the engineers are responsible for building the thing right and the product managers are responsible for building the right thing. I'm sure you've heard that phrase before. And so I hear a lot at the moment about the end of product managers. It's like that we won't need product managers anymore. It's all going to be done by Gen AI. But I actually think the reverse is true. I think what's going to happen is that the demand for good product managers is going to go through the roof, because the problem that Gen AI solves is the stuff that, like, the kind of the grudge work, right? The paper pushing, the admin stuff. That's well and truly solved by Gen AI. And I think this, if you can I think this pattern applies across the board. And I think the demand for good software engineers is going to go through the roof, because the difference between a software engineer and a good software engineer using Claude is that one of them's going to generate, both of them are going to generate hundreds of thousands of lines of code. One of them is going to throw away 60% of that code.
Sure.
Right?
And
because they know
the right 40% is your point, right?
Yep. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, because they know what good looks like, and they know how to say no, right? Whereas the, left to their own devices, a bad engineer and something like Claude is just a spray gun of
A bug making machine, right?
Yeah.
And James, to get back to your original question, I think that like knowing fundamentals is even more important. Yeah. And for a new dev, I am not sure, this is an open question, I'm not sure how you get those fundamentals, right? Like, you know, but I do know that like, if you have a curiosity for those fundamentals, you now have an amazing teacher to like co-learn with you, right? Like a senior engineer who will never get tired and never get bored and never, you know, say, hey, I have to go to lunch, but you still need to work on those fundamentals, because you need to have that taste and you need to have that intuition to be able to guide the AI in the future.
There's really good advice. And just to back that up, a lot of the companies I work with are early stage startups, and a lot of their roles I recruit as software, like full stack software engineers, product engineers, and more recently sort of like AI, ML type roles. And what I've found interesting is how much more important it is now, no matter where you sit, whether you're ML engineer, backend engineer, or a full stack, the product knowledge or the product sense is like equally as important almost as a lot of the technical skills. And these candidates that tend to do well in this are the ones that are actually quite opinionated. And when you ask them a question like, what is a product that you rate really highly, they're really quick to answer that. And they do have an opinion on it. It's not to say they don't think it can't be better. Like, for example, if they said, I think Notion is a great product, they may have ways to improve it, but if they don't know, or they give a really bad product, generally they haven't really thought about it. So I think it's really important to have opinions on what you do, and don't be afraid to be out there with it, because the ones that sit on the fence are the ones that often don't get that far through processes, in my experience as a recruiter.
Yeah, I want to chime in on that. Like, this is something that took me so, so long to learn, is that if you're kind of middle of the road, like average, like, or you agree with everything, or you are not opinionated, you're not going to stand out. If you are opinionated, some people, you'll turn some people off, and but you'll turn some other people on. And that second category is a way better place to be, even though I'm not going to lie and say it's comfortable. It is way scary. Right, those people who come into those interviews and they're opinionated, they may turn off the interviewer, or the interviewer may have a totally different point of view. But like, if things align, then it's a hell yes, right? And so, and again, I don't want to talk to your listeners and say, oh, it's so easy to do. It's really scary to do. It's really hard to do. But it just leads to much better alignment and a much better, you know, working relationship in my mind.
Yeah.
History very rarely remembers the everyman, right? History tends to remember the iconoclasts. So if you do want to leave some kind of legacy, or have something to remember that the world remembers you by, you're much more likely to have that happen if you're an iconoclast than you are if you just follow the rules.
I think on that as well, if you're a good hiring manager, someone who's interviewing candidates and they have a strong opinion on something that you don't agree with, back to what you said before about like context and like understanding someone's situation, there's two things. One, as a candidate that might be going for a role or trying to have an influence, having that opinion, even if that hiring manager doesn't agree with it, doesn't mean that it won't be a positive outcome for you. I've had someone knock back recently where the feedback was they just didn't have an opinion. They were on the fence about everything. And I know that this candidate was a good candidate, but they probably felt, they felt like they were worried to upset or be too strong opinionated, because they thought that was going to be negative for them. So have some confidence if you believe in something.
Have an opinion and then like have some reasoning behind it, right? Like, yes, that's really what most people are looking for. Again, back to, it's problem solving. So if I'm like, PHP is the best. And the hiring manager hates PHP, but I can say, hey, here are the reasons why it's good. Here's the context where I'd use it. That's way stronger than being like, I like whatever you guys use, right? I don't care, right? Anyway, sorry, Matt.
No, not at all. The strong opinions weekly held sentiment is pretty cliched these days. It's kind of used everywhere. But the thing that I try and encourage in my teams is this idea of respectful disagreement. Mm-hmm. And what I like, sometimes I'll do it because maybe the team doesn't necessarily want to do it, but it's always useful to have a dissenting opinion. And the dissenting opinion, because it's about the idea, not the people, right? So you need to know how to give a dissenting opinion. But, you know, we look at the Supreme Court or in Cabinet, you know, doctrine of cabinet solidarity in the Westminster system. It's essential that people disagree because you don't get to the right idea, the highest quality idea outcome, unless you've got some challenge. Now, it's also essential to disagree and commit on the way out. But it's a skill. Learning how to disagree respectfully is a skill that I think people should really think about. Both parties, right? The person disagreeing and they're a person being disagreed with. Mm. It's a skill. Both of those things are skills. You have to learn how to do it, to be disagreed with and not take it personally, and be able to disagree with someone respectfully and not offend them because you're attacking them and not the idea.
Totally. And then I will also add just a little bit of like flavor is that knowing when to do that is appropriate, right? You know, early stages, that's awesome. When we've already spent $10 million on this project and you're like, you know, then you haven't really committed, right? Or
I'm conscious of time now, but we did touch on something at the start, Dan, and that was...
We're not going to let you get away with it.
Wait, that was in my intro that you crashed a national TV site, and I'm sure there was a lot of lessons learned from that, but love to hear a little bit about that story, if you don't mind sharing.
Yeah, maybe my notes were a little bit inaccurate, but what it was a sporting event that y'all have heard of, and it was being televised on national TV in the US, and we were responsible for the website behind it. And so what happened is I did not do the sufficient prep work because I thought that previous conditions would still apply. Basically, we'd done some load testing the year before, everything was fine, I was busy, I was like, I don't need to do load testing again, you know, nothing's really changed. And it fell over. And basically, visitors to the website during the event were basically saw like a blue screen of death, it's like a plain white page, and it was horrendous. And one lesson I learned from there is obviously do the prep work. Another lesson I learned is I looked around and found one change, and I kind of jumped to the conclusion, and actually I threw a team member under the bus who made that change, and it turned out he hadn't actually made that change. And so I learned that, you know, incident review and incident analysis is a whole separate discipline, right? Just like engineering management. And I learned that I needed to be more diligent about that aspect of things because I don't think that, you know, everything got sorted out. The client's still with the company. Everything's great. But like, it felt pretty horrible for the person that I blamed. And it felt pretty horrible for me when I learned that I was in the wrong. So.
Yeah.
So did your team in the game?
It wasn't a team sport.
Oh, okay. All right. I won't ask any more questions.
And I can't, unfortunately, I can't really like reveal the
name. I was going to ask that, but no.
Definitely one of the low points in my career. Back to failure, right? Like I learned some things from this. It still gives me the heebie-jeebies when I think about that situation, but I guarantee you in that situation in the future, I'm always going to be more conscious of those lessons that I learned.
Yeah. Yeah, that's interesting. And unfortunately, even when you tell someone a story like that, it really takes you going through that to really to hit home, doesn't it? I know that from personal experience, not as a software engineer, but just in life. You know, your parents tell you something 10 times and then you ignore them, and then all of a sudden you experience it and you go, wow, I would never do that again.
I have this quite controversial perspective on this kind of thing, which is there's no such thing as teaching. There's only learning.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm feeling I've got two young kids now, and you know, you realize like what it must have been like for your own parents when they you're telling a child to do something and why, and then it just goes out the window, and then eventually something bad happens, and you think, oh, gosh, well at least they'll learn. And I think there's a lot of stuff we could have covered here with you, Dan, and I think we should probably try and get you back on again. Before we wrap up, though, can you share with us, I'll put some notes in the description, but where we can find out some of your website and about the book that you mentioned, like where can we find out this information about you?
I'd love to come back at some point in the future, only if you ask me about other big failures that I am embarrassed about. That's amazing. No, but you can find me. I'm on blueskymoreds.com. I'm my current employer is fusionauth.io, and I write for the blog there, and I write some articles. I'm on LinkedIn. If you search for Dan Moore Boulder, I'll pop up. And then Letters to New Developer. You can find the book in any bookseller, but it's letterstoanewdeveloper.com, all spelled out. And I'd love to have people give it a read and give me feedback. And I appreciate the opportunity to chat with you both. It was really interesting.
Yeah, fantastic. Thanks for spending the time. It was great.
Thanks a lot.
All right. James, see you next time.
See you next time. Bye.
Dan, thank you. Bye.
See you later. Bye.